KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up, a small farm town moves beyond a controversial terrorism case and reading, writing, and arithmetic without leaving the house, the new world of virtual schools.
I like it. It's more fun because you can just like watch TV and do an assignment or eat breakfast and take my time, and then I can just mosey over to the computer and start my class.
Also, a new exhibit converts internet chatter into a symphony of sound, and an endangered butterfly makes a big comeback.
The males flicker around all over the females. You know, the female's a little more of a brown color, and the males are bright blue, really, really striking color. And they're all over the place, dancing all over the female, trying to get her attention.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and we'll try to get your attention. It's the California Report. This week's anniversary of the 9/11 attacks was the backdrop for a prison sentence handed out in a controversial terrorism case in California. On Monday, a federal judge in Sacramento sentenced a Pakistani man from Lodi to 24 years in prison. Hamid Hayat was convicted of attending a terrorist training camp in Pakistan, then lying to the FBI about it. After the sentencing, U.S. Attorney McGregor Scott tied the case to the federal government's efforts to prevent another terror attack on American soil.
This successful prosecution demonstrates that we will utilize every legal tool available to us to ensure we, our children, and our children's children never have to relive the horror of that day.
The case was controversial in part because it relied heavily on information provided by a paid FBI informant. Hyatt's defenders say he was pressured to confess during an FBI interrogation and didn't really understand what he was doing. This week's sentencing of Hamid Hayat is the latest chapter of a terrorism investigation that began more than 2 years ago with the arrest of Hayat and his father, Umar Hayat. The father's trial ended with a hung jury. He later pleaded guilty to lesser charges, and he still lives in Lodi. The terror investigation stunned the sleepy farming community 35 miles south of Sacramento, putting a spotlight on the town's small but growing Pakistani and Muslim communities. At the Lodi Mosque on Poplar Street Tuesday, about 40 men left their shoes at the door and walked barefoot into the modest building for afternoon prayers. The men stand in a line facing Mecca, their heads covered. They pray silently, alternating between standing, then kneeling down and bending forward, their foreheads, nose, and palms on the rug. After a few minutes, they put on their shoes and quietly leave the mosque for the parking lot out back. Most of them drive off quickly, perhaps to avoid a reporter's microphone. 19-year-old Jaber Ismail is willing to talk, and he expresses a quiet outrage over the Hayat case.
Everybody knows in the community, every single person knows in their heart that they're innocent. The trial that they had was injustice.
Hamid Hayat was arrested after returning to the U.S. from Pakistan. The FBI claimed he was planning to commit violence here. Jaber Ismail is Hamid Hayat's first cousin. He says they played together growing up and that the 25-year-old Hayat is no terrorist.
He was just a normal kid living his life. He was lazy. He used to just watch movies every day, play cricket. That was his whole life.
Like many small towns that suddenly find themselves at the center of international media attention, Lodi was invaded by journalists after the Hayats were first arrested in 2005. Bob Johnson is Lodi's mayor. He says reaction to this week's sentencing has been relatively quiet in most of Lodi.
My emails haven't been overflowing. I haven't received phone calls. People on the street haven't come up to me and said, boy, good, bad, or indifferent.
The FBI investigation led to the deportation of two Islamic clerics affiliated with the mosque and, Johnson says, put a spotlight on residents who were previously under the radar.
I think it brought out the fact that we do have this group of people who, you know, are citizens in our community. They're workers. They pay taxes. They send their kids to school. They use our parks and playgrounds. But we haven't noticed them.
Johnson says as a result of the terror case, new lines of communication have opened up. As an example, he says Lodi created the town's first cricket field. Lodi hasn't always been known as a place that's hospitable to diversity. This town of 63,000 is nearly 75% white, and there's been racial tension over the years. A cross-burning incident at a local high school a decade ago prompted the creation of a group called the Breakthrough Project, its aim to increase racial tolerance in Lodi. One of its leaders is Taj Khan, a retired Pakistani-American engineer. Sitting at Dee Dee's restaurant during the lunch hour this week, Khan insists that the entire case against Hamid Hayat was a miscarriage of justice.
He didn't do anything wrong. He didn't kill anybody. The murderers do not get this kind of sentence, but he was persecuted for his thoughts, his ideas. He was reading the wrong books.
A few years ago, Khan's group worked to develop closer ties between Muslims, Jews, and Christians. That all stopped after 9/11. Still, despite the serious bumps in the road, Khan insists Lodi is not the redneck community some people say it is.
I've been living here for almost a quarter of a century, and I have... It has people who are not very open to the other minorities. But overall, I think Lodi has been a very peaceful place. It's a very good place for raising a family. And we have enjoyed living here.
In recent years, Lodi has cultivated a reputation for wine. That spirit was on display this week in preparation for the Lodi Grape Festival. Farm workers unloaded crates of grapes off the back of a flatbed truck and carted them into a cavernous pavilion. Inside, dozens of volunteers are scrambling to get ready for this weekend's event.
Right now we're kind of doing the finishing touches, filling in and snipping off, like I'm doing right now, snipping off the grapes so that they can be glued and placed evenly.
Volunteer Shelley Bandoni is snipping the stems off hundreds of grapes for her group's grape mural. This year's theme is Great American Heroes. And Bandoni's mural is a tribute to the U.S. military. It includes a depiction of Marines raising the flag at Iwo Jima, made almost entirely of grapes. In between snipping and gluing, Bandoni applauds the 24-year sentence Hayat received this week, but she expresses concern for his family and what they're going through. And she struggles to avoid judging the entire Muslim community in Lodi based on the actions of one person.
You know, we were raising children. We don't want them to question others, and we want to be able to trust people, and that it does, it makes it hard, because like 9/11, you have to, after that all happened, it changed us forever. You kind of have to judge sometimes, and I don't like being put in that position.
Across the room, contractor John Wiest also approves of Hyatt's sentence, but insists he has no problem with Lodi's growing Pakistani community as long as they want to assimilate.
I'm a Vietnam vet, so I'm all for this country. If you want to come here and live peaceably and do what you should be doing the right way, that's fine with me. I have no animosity towards anybody, any culture.
Lodi was first made famous by a Creedence Clearwater Revival song in the late 60s, with lyrics complaining about being stuck in Lodi. Now, the town is most identified with Hamid and Umar Hayat. But Mayor Johnson is hoping that image, too, will pass.
It's a cliche, but I hope that people don't remember and think of Lodi as the quote-unquote terrorist capital of the free Western world. And we're not like that. We've got a lot of strong attributes and positives, and come on over and take a visit.
You can see pictures of our visit to Lodi, including that Iwo Jima mural at the Lodi Grape Festival, at our website, californiareport.org. The Internet has revolutionized so much of our lives, including how California students are learning. More and more are attending school in cyberspace. But as the number of these virtual schools grows, so do the concerns regarding online learning. KPBS's Anna Tintakalis reports from San Diego.
It's 7 in the morning, and a group of high school students is scrambling to get to class on time. But imagine if all those students didn't physically have to go to class. Imagine if all they had to do is roll out of bed and log onto their computer. For 17-year-old Michael Sosnowski, that's a reality.
I like it. It's more fun because you can just, watch TV and do an assignment or eat breakfast and take my time, and then I can just mosey over to the computer and start my class.
Michael is one of 400 students enrolled at National University Virtual High School, a private school based in San Diego that's completely online. Most of its cyber students are spread out across California, but some are in other states and some even in other countries. Michael lives in North San Diego County. He says so far he likes the online learning experience.
you're not always psyched for learning when you're going to school and you're not always ready and you might be tired. But here you're kind of like, oh, I feel like kind of doing some schoolwork right now, so might as well do it.
Michael is one of many ambitious students who take online courses to get into advanced high school classes. Others have been homeschooled or simply don't have easy access to a classroom. Kimberly Kopp is a teacher at National University's virtual school.
So if you have a student that's in Europe, for example, who is a professional sports star or something along those lines, that student can come off the court, do the course, go right back on the court, no problem. And you have students that are, say, have medical conditions and can't leave the hospital.
Online learning first came on the scene in California about 10 years ago, and the industry has been steadily growing ever since. Right now, 45 school districts, universities, and agencies offer online learning programs in places like Monterey and San Diego. Some charge tuition while others are free. Nancy Roland Heinrich is the general manager of National University's virtual high school.
Today's high school students are digital natives. They've had internet access and using technology since literally they were toddlers. Unfortunately, most kids have only used technology and internet more as a recreational tool. And so this provides them an opportunity to see that education can be fun and interactive.
Online learning is a multimedia experience, but there are practical reasons why students enroll. Many cyber schools offer advanced placement courses that some traditional schools don't offer. Cyber schools also give students the flexibility to study at their own pace, and they give kids an easy way to retake a class. Teacher Kimberly Kopp gives a virtual tour of the campus.
So I'm a student who's enrolled in marine science.
Okay.
The course home link is the first place where I start. So this is kind of like, you know,
your first day of class.
The first day of class.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Kopp taught in traditional schools for more than a decade before turning to online learning. She says some kids and teachers just do better in cyberspace.
As an instructor in a traditional style brick and mortar type classroom, you always have that kid that sits in the back of the classroom that doesn't say anything. And to me, in an online environment, it was really easy to engage that kid. It was powerful.
While an increasing number of states run online education programs, California has been slow to come on board. The only state-run program offered is by the University of California. Some state educators and lawmakers worry online learning deprives students of socialization skills. Others are concerned about academic standards. San Diego School Board member Sheila Jackson says that's why she's skeptical when a group of educators want to establish a new virtual school.
Because there is no walls, we're not able to define who your students are. Are your students real students? Are they students from other nations? How does this teacher interact with the students?
Critics also worry virtual schools are springing up faster than the rules that govern them. For example, the University of California just adopted a stricter policy that limits the type of internet courses allowed on college transcripts because too many students were cheating or taking easy online classes. To address these concerns, the North American Council on Online Learning just released a national set of standards for virtual schools. They're designed to ensure online programs have everything from certified teachers to rigorous courses. Experts say those measures are extremely important because the online trend is not slowing down anytime soon. For the California Report, I'm Anna Tentakulis in San Diego.
Over a billion people worldwide use the Internet, so what does all that online activity sound like? Two artists decided to create music out of the global buzz of the Internet. They do it by data mining in chat rooms and snatching the text from instant messages and blogs. Their project, called Listening Post, recently opened to enthusiastic crowds in San Francisco. Reporter Fani Evnokides went to see and hear it and to find out whether this emerging art form is here to stay or just a passing high art infatuation.
To experience Listening Post, you enter a dimly lit room. Directly in front of you, there's an arc of 231 small display screens hanging like a curtain in vertical rows. Suddenly, neon green LED text starts washing over the screens from right to left. Stray snippets of internet chatter start popping up, text fragments culled from thousands of internet forums and read by a voice synthesizer. The effect is something like a Dadaist found poem. Sound artist Ben Rubin created this piece with statistician Mark Hansen. It pulls live feed from the internet, and since the text is gathered and processed in the last hour, each performance of Listening Post is unique.
So in essence, what you have is almost like a symphony that represents the internet.
Joanne Northrup is senior curator at the San Jose Museum of Art, which owns the piece and loaned it out to San Francisco's Yerba Buena Center for the current show.
It's what people are talking about, what they care about. And the most frequently used sentences begin with the words, I am, I like, and I love. And so it just becomes this real existential piece. It makes you realize that everyone's just on the internet trying to connect.
Listening to internet chatter and watching the green text flowing like liquid over the screens, it's easy to imagine that this data stream embodies a beehive of buzzing global consciousness, especially when the individual statements are subsumed by a vast collective babble. Internet art has been around for about a decade, and it's taking a leap from computer screens to bask in the brighter limelight of big audiences at major museums. Artists have always experimented with the latest technology of their time, from the advent of photography to video and electronic art. But is internet art just a flash in the artistic pan, or could it become an established art genre? Museum visitors had different ideas.
I'm so hesitant to compare it to sculpture and painting, as I mean, but I guess I would have to say it is a viable medium.
When she saw the piece at the San Jose Museum, visitor Elizabeth Koenigan had never seen internet art before.
I think it is kind of made me think how interconnected we are. You know, it sounds passé or whatever, but yeah, all the different languages that would come up and the different words completely unrelated to people. And so, yeah, it reminds you of how big the world is.
But Cecilia Hernandez, a student at the National Hispanic University in San Jose, said she was left a little cold.
To me, I don't like it. It separates you from the human interactions. But I don't know. Some people like it, and I respect that too. But I didn't enjoy it.
And some museum visitors, like Tom Hogan, said they enjoyed the experience but didn't quite get it.
No idea what it means. I have no idea what it is.
It might take a while for the general public to warm up to internet art. But according to Rudolf Freeling, the curator of media arts at San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, a piece like Listening Post makes this new genre more accessible.
This is certainly one of the most astounding artworks that you can find in the field of digital art or media art. It's astounding because it's not only related to emerging and most recent technologies based on internet technologies, but it's also aesthetically, visually, and acoustically a unique experience.
But, curator Joanne Northrup says, this kind of art is still in its nascent phase.
Many artists are going to begin considering digital art and the internet as another medium to use, just like oil on canvas and just like sculpture. It's just going to be another tool in their toolbox. So I think it's going to become more widespread over time.
However, internet art is still a rare sight in most museums. For now, Californians who want to seek it out can find it at San Francisco's Museum of Modern Art, the San Jose Museum of Art, University Centers for Art and Technology, and some smaller arts venues. And of course, you can also get a virtual gallery experience at home on the net with just a few clicks of the mouse. For the California Report, I'm Fani Avnakides.
You're listening to the California Report. This week we continue our California Songs series with the Brooklyn band The Ladybug Transistor. We spoke with the band's lead singer and writer Gary Olson about the story behind their song, California Stopover.
Tell me there's no room left to reason. Time.
California Stopover was sort of influenced by an album title by Johnny Darrell, who was a Nashville singer type, and he went out there and made this record in California with a bunch of Los Angeles session musicians, and it was sort of his break out of Nashville.
Lines, crossing lines, and we have not said a prayer.
You know, growing up in Brooklyn, I'd never been to California before when I started writing a bit about it, and it's more of an imagined California even still when you write about it. I mean, saying California to someone from the East Coast, at least, like, just it conjures up a lot of images. I think the only thing I really knew about California was just, like, from, you know, the covers of old Beach Boys records in my uncle's bedroom, you know.
Tell me there's no room left to reason, and say it now if you dare. Lies, all these lies, but I do hope that you still care.
When we got to the end of that song, we really wanted something to lift it up. And, you know, the words sounded good. It was kind of funny because it almost sounds like an advertisement for California, like if there was one of those, you know, short commercials that you'd see in New York that could kind of be the refrain. I think that was the idea, our own jingle for California. Yeah. It was almost sort of just a big welcome to people, even though we're not actually from California.
Gary Olson of the Ladybug Transistor talking about their song California Stopover. You can find it on their most recent CD, Can't Wait Another Day. Now, from ladybugs to butterflies. The El Segundo blue butterfly used to call the Southern California coast from Marina del Rey to Palos Verdes home. Coastal development put the insect on the endangered species list. But the El Segundo blue is spreading its wings once again, thanks to efforts to restore the insect's native habitat. KPCC's Jordan Davis has more.
If you want to find the El Segundo blue butterfly, look for the plant it calls home.
The scientific name is Areogonum parvifolium, which is the dune buckwheat.
Monica Acosta is with the L.A. Conservation Corps.
And you see the white clusters of flowers that are absolutely beautiful. They range from a nice white color, creamy color, to a rosy color, pink.
It may be pretty flowers to humans, but for the El Segundo blue, the dune buckwheat means the world. The butterflies lay their eggs on the plant. They feast on its nectar. They even use it as a crash pad.
At night, they will go underneath the plant and sleep. They come out when it's nice and sunny, and the males flicker around all over the females. You know, the female's a little more of a brown color, and the males are bright blue, really, really striking color. And they're all over the place, dancing all over the female, trying to get her attention.
Acosta says the dancing butterflies caught the attention of Conservation Corps members at the Dockweiler State Beach a few weeks ago. It was the first time anyone had seen the insects there. They settled onto a strip of land replanted with native vegetation like the dune buckwheat. The butterfly's appearance is kind of a reward for Alvaro Morales.
I actually came out of here where there was nothing, where it was just nothing but sand.
Morales was in his late teens when he first joined the Conservation Corps, restoring the beach's native plants. Now he's earned the rank of supervisor, and the Dockweiler ecosystem is earning its stripes, too.
Not only butterflies, we have little insects that come out, a lot of beetles, a lot of lizards that we didn't see here before are here now.
Doc Weiler is just across the street from the Butterfly Preserve off the end of LAX's South Runways. Compared to the transcontinental flights taking off overhead, the butterflies made a relatively short trip. But their cousins down the coast took a much longer flight. They flew from a colony at Malaga Cove to recently restored coastal bluffs in Redondo Beach and Torrance. Travis Longcore with the Urban Wildlands Group says nobody expected that to happen.
The previous research suggested that it was very sedentary, that it didn't go very far. And some of the studies done in the 80s suggested that an adult might move 200 feet. Well, it made it over 1,000 feet.
One giant leap for a little butterfly, but one small step towards getting off the federal endangered species list. To do that, the butterflies have to be fruitful and multiply, and they have to settle in on the habitat they're reclaiming for at least a decade. For the California Report, I'm Jordan Davis in Los Angeles.
That's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. We had additional engineering from Tom Krimkowski, Danny Bringer, and Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are Deidre Crawford and Megan McCarty. Lita Martinez helped produce our California song. The producer is Victoria Malione. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. Our news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have yourself a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Walter S. Johnson Foundation, Osh Complete Home and Garden, offering service and selection to Californians for over 75 years. Ideas, tips, and solutions at osh.com. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.